Blog Talk Radio.
We honor now the Celtic Bard, we offer up our praise. Guardians of our mysteries, keepers of the old days.
Good evening and welcome, Gaias and fans of Voices of the Sacred Feminine across town and across the globe, where we discuss goddess as deity, archetype, and ideal, or the feminine consciousness, sometimes it's called right brain thinking, and actually how women of the West are being called upon to save the world. In case you didn't know, the Dalai Lama actually confirmed that, what we always knew, right? Well, I have to give a shout out to the wonderful artists who so generously allow me to use their music every week. So here is a plug for Jenna Green. And the snippet of that song you heard at our opening was her song called The Bard's Song, B-A-R-D-S, The Bard's Song. Well, thank you for continuing to tune in during the Four Mothers and Way Shower series. Tonight our guest is the scholar and artist Christina Biaggi, and we're going to be talking about the goddess mound and her derivatives. As a sculptor, Dr. Biaggi has designed a formidable outdoor sculpture of the great goddess as a temple that can be entered, with the outside being a grass-covered earth mound and the inside being the negative shape of a female figure giving birth. Christina is looking for a suitable site at a museum or academic institution or sculpture garden for this walk-through goddess mound sculpture slash structure. So we're going to be hearing a lot about that tonight, and I believe you can probably see it on her website at christinabiaggi.com, C-R-I-S-T-I-N-A-B-I-A-G-G-I. Dr. Biaggi's work, in case you don't know her, reflects her strong desire to provide women today with an opportunity to experience a connection with the goddess within themselves. It's her hope that she will motivate women to seek to build a more peaceful and caring society. We'll also discuss her expertise, if we have time, in the Paleolithic and Neolithic cultures as it pertains to her interest in work. But just a few things before we get to Foremother Christina. I'd like you to please stay tuned for our What's the Buzz segment tonight. We skipped it the last few weeks because of the jam-packed discussions on each show, but it's back this week so you can hear about those bees buzzing around in my bonnet and just dying to get out. They've been stuck in there for 2 weeks. There is so much to discuss, so many ideals of goddess being violated out there, so much history and truth being rewritten and seeming pride being taken in anti-intellectualism and what I call the dumbing down of our fellow Americans. Exploitation, inequality, oppression, intolerance, racism, sexism, those isms, unfortunately, are alive and well, and they are not goddess ideals. So at the bottom of the hour, after my interview with Christina, some of the topics will include quite frankly, the ugliness and fear-mongering of some of the loud Christian culture, namely all the homophobia that's rising to the surface more than usual because of the strong possibility Don't Ask, Don't Tell will be overturned, and the need for non-discrimination in all jobs for all people, not just the military. I want to share an email that went out to Dr. Laura Schlesinger about harmful ideas and dictates of the Bible and the prayers by Christians that our president would die. Sound familiar? Yes, the Christian Coalition was hoping liberal judges on the Supreme Court would die soon, not that long ago, and now just recently they were asking for prayers from their constituency that our president would die. We're going to be talking about, are we walking our talk when it comes to spirituality and politics? Or are we supporting those who would throw our ideals under the bus? You might not know, but a new study came out over the week of Super Bowl, and it said that football upsets, in other words, when one's team loses, actually does increase domestic violence. Now, we had only had anecdotal evidence for that, but there's a study I'm going to tell you about that actually does support that idea. Costa Rica elects its first woman president, we'll mention that, and pagan pride events around the globe. We're going to talk about what we can accomplish when we work together on a common goal. And I'll close out the evening with announcements of wonderful events around Southern California and afar. So stay tuned after our guest tonight through What's the Buzz, so you'll be sure to be in the loop in case there's something exciting happening near you. And thanks again to those of you who have sent in email questions and articles to share. You know who you are. And remember, listeners, you can call in and talk to my guest and myself. The call-in number is 718-766-4662. And if you're the type of person who maybe doesn't want to talk live on the air, remember, you can always email me questions in advance, and I am happy to pose those questions to our wonderful guests. But without further delay, let me turn my attention to this week's guest, foremother and way shower Christina Biaggi. Let me tell you more about this incredibly accomplished woman whose work I believe is so important out there. Dr. Biaggi is a popular lecturer and author of Habitations of the Great Goddess and In the Footsteps of Goddess, both published by Knowledge, Ideas, and Trends. She has a long list of credentials here. Hang on one second.
Can I correct you with one thing?
Sure.
My name is pronounced Biaggi.
Biaggi. Oh, thank you so much. You know, Christina, I've never actually heard anyone say it. I've only seen it in print. So I appreciate that. I really do. Biaggi. She is the quintessential Renaissance woman with passions and accomplishments that knows no boundaries. In addition to artistic pursuits, she's a pilot, a scuba diver, a photographer, a costume and set designer, a mountain climber. Christina, where do you find the time?
I don't do all those things right now. I mean, you know, I do some of them.
They're all part of what make you who you are. I mean, those are, pretty exciting things.
Yes, they are. Yeah, they are. Indeed.
Well, Christina, how did you come to all of this? Were there any specific childhood experiences that helped you develop an interest in art and art history or archaeology? Tell us, give us some background. How did you become the woman you are today?
Well, I was born and partly brought up in Europe, in Italy, and I had a very good teacher whose name is Anna Maria Quiet, who told me wonderful stories about, mythological stories and things like that. And so she spent a lot of time with me. And I had also a mother who inspired me with feminist thoughts and a governess. I had a lot of women around me that inspired me and helped me become the person that I am today with the passions and interests that I have.
Well, do you think that it helped growing up in Europe versus growing up here in the United States? Do you see a cultural difference?
Well, yes. This is after the war, and, Europe was devastated, but Europe is very, very rich, and here in America, we were going into the 50s. When I came to the United States, it was in 1948, and the 50s were terrible. I mean, things were so regimented and backward and so on.
Well, I'm thinking about the women in their high heels and pearls vacuuming the floor.
And their girdles,
Yes. Oh, and their girdles, of course, and those pointy bras, too. I remember my mother had one of those. I mean, her breast actually came to a point like it was a funnel or something. That sure brings me back. So tell us more about that. Where did that take you then from your childhood? Then what was the next step?
Well, first of all, I was brought up a Catholic, you know, and as I was growing up, I just felt instinctually that there was something lacking in God. I felt that God was a later incursion and an addendum. And in the early 70s, when I was looking for a proper dissertation topic for my master's dissertation, I went to the library, and this book almost fell, you know, in my lap. And it was, you know, I've heard other stories like this.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it just appears when you need to see it.
Right, exactly. And this is exactly what happened. It was the book Mothers and Amazons by Helen Diner. And I opened it up, and the words that came to me that I read was, and I quote, "In the beginning there was a woman. The man only appears as the son, as a biological younger and later phenomenon. The female is the older, the more powerful, and the most aboriginal of the two mysterious fundamental forms." And I, you know, that really got me thinking. And my whole mind, my being became propelled on the quest of this, you know, of this goddess. So I wanted to learn as much as possible, and I started to read. I'd already read Jane Harrison and Robert Briefaux and Bakoff and E.O. James and so on, and Joseph Campbell especially. But then I came across the work of Maria Gimbutas. And while these other people talked about the goddess peripherally, or they talked about her, you know, not as center stage, Maria Gimbutas talked about her as in center stage. And in her book, Gods and Goddesses of Old Europe.
So now, at this time, were you still influenced by your Catholic upbringing, or had you sort of left that behind by then?
No. Once I went to Vassar, I kind of gave up the Catholic Church. I went to church for a few weekends, and then I decided that it wasn't for me.
Well, you know, I grew up in New Orleans, a Catholic myself, and I refer to myself now as a recovered Catholic. I got over it, and, you know, it life goes on, thank goodness. But so then, you know, from here, so I'm assuming then, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, this knowledge of goddess, that started to affect your art.
Oh, sure. But there's one thing, going back to Catholicism, there's one good thing about Catholicism, and that's the Virgin Mary.
Uh-huh.
And at first, don't you think so?
Yes.
At first, you think that she's very subsumed to God and so on. But then you see that she's very powerful. I mean, she's, you know, the temples or churches are dedicated to her. She's the great goddess. You know.
Oh, of course. I mean, who is it the people are, you know, crawling on their knees to see, you know, and I mean, it's Mary. I mean, Mary's got all the power.
Yes.
I mean, maybe not in the organized church, but at the grassroots level, it's Mary.
Oh, at the grassroots, she definitely does. And that's the goddess.
Absolutely.
As we have a goddess in New York Harbor, you know, the Statue of Liberty.
Mm-hmm. Lady Libertas, absolutely.
Yes.
Goddess of social justice and freedom. So, all right. So goddess now enters your psyche. What was the first piece of art you created that was influenced by your knowledge of goddess?
Well, the one of the first pieces that I created, I created some minor pieces, but one of the major pieces that I created in the 70s was a Medusa piece, the U Medusa, and you can see her on my website.
Okay.
She's actually I use my face, my own face, as a model, and she's depicted smiling with a very sardonic grin. She's a wooden piece. And basically what happened was she's made out of you. And you, later on, because I didn't know this when I, you know, in the 70s, I was just starting out. And you turns out to be sacred to the goddess Hecate. It's the wood that's sacred to the goddess Hecate. So, and Hecate is connected, of course, to Medusa. So I had this ewe that had died in my backyard, and my sister came to walk my dogs with me and to walk her dogs. We both share some dogs, and she saw this ewe, uprooted ewe, and she said, "Oh, Chris, this is wonderful. This ewe looks just like Medusa." And of course, you know, my mind started to race, and I suddenly saw the Medusa in the tree.
Mm.
And then 108 hours later, you know, it took me a long time to carve it.
Wow.
There was the face of Medusa.
How big is the piece, actually?
It's life size. It's life size and with snakes, you know.
Mm. Well, I can't wait to go look at that on your website, actually. Somehow I must have missed that.
Well, it's right there. It's the, you know, the first image on my website.
Okay,
it's
wonderful.
Her face. You don't see the snakes as well, but I mean you.
So now, how do you see Medusa, Christina? You know, what does she represent to you?
Well, she represents a very ancient incarnation of the goddess. You know, a prehistoric goddess. Medusa with her snake hair. The snake is the telluric or the earth alter ego of the goddess, the way the bird is her aerial alter ego. So the snake is very important to the goddess. And so Medusa having snakes is, you know, a direct connection with the great goddess. And the fact that Medusa can turn people into stone indicates that she's a goddess of death. You know, she turns people into tombstones or into stones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So is it your belief, you know, in feminist theology that Medusa becomes this evil one as a result of, you know, the patriarchal lens or the Christian lens?
Oh, yes. Medusa definitely becomes an evil one with the patriarchal overlay. But underneath, she's a very powerful goddess like Kali or, you know, some of the other dark goddesses.
And she becomes demonized just like the snake, which is the symbol of goddess.
Exactly. She becomes demonized.
Well, I mean, as an artist, you can probably verbalize better than the non-artist, you know, the importance of art and sacred symbol. Could you just maybe say something to my listeners about that so that they can, you know, fully appreciate what, the magnitude really of sacred art and symbols? You know, what does it do for us? What does it convey?
Well, sacred art and symbols, I mean, art to begin with, way back when, in the Paleolithic caves, the little figurines that you see, the countless figurines that go back to Paleolithic times, art was sacred during those times, and it was considered alive. It was considered mysterious. It was considered to be a link to the other world. It had that function. It had a shamanistic function. So I think in many ways art has lost that, and I'm for bringing that back. I'm for bringing the sacred mystery of art back.
And would you say too that at a time when people weren't literate, that it also helped convey common meanings? You know, so that, people could, understand a concept without the written word.
Exactly. And it's very connected with language, too.
Were there any particular symbols that, just sort of inspired you or haunt you or, I'm just curious, anything really just, stokes your passions?
Well, some of the ancient figurines, the cave paintings, going back to the cave paintings, the hands, the sacred hands on the walls, some of the bird images, the snake images on the walls, that travel from the Neolithic, from the Paleolithic to the Neolithic. You see them again in the Neolithic art, in some of the figurines.
Well, speaking of the figurines, and I mean, I associate those so much with Maria Gimbutas, and okay. I'm looking at your credentials and stuff, and you were lucky enough to be one of the people in Signs Out of Time. What was that like for you? I mean, being able to participate in that project to highlight Maria's life.
Oh, that was wonderful. That was wonderful. Donna, let's see, what was her name? What is her name? Signs Out of Time, the person who did that.
Oh, I'm trying
Donna,
to think myself.
Yes, Donna.
Well, it's Belili. It's Belili Productions, B-E-L-I-L-I. And for anyone who's interested, they can go to Belili Productions and find out about this film called The Signs Out of Time
about
Maria.
Signs Out of Time, yes. And I'm trying to think of her name. I know her name is Donna, and I can see her face in front of me, but I can't think of her last name.
Well, they can find her at Belili, B-E-L-I-L-I.
Yes, they can. Yeah, yeah.
So let's go back to a little bit to, What sort of inspired you, at your core, Christina? I mean, when you came to know Goddess, was it something, I know you've described it a little bit, but was it something instantaneous? I mean, was it just a slippery slope for you or a gradual awakening? How did it manifest in your life?
Well, as soon as I started my, researching for my master's project and so on, and then later on with my PhD project, I started reading the books of Maria Gimbutas, and also another book that influenced me greatly was Michael Dames, The Silvery Treasure and the Avebury Project, and in which he talked about some of these megalithic monuments that you see in, especially in the British Isles, but you also see them in France, and they're all over the place in Europe,
mm-hmm.
and also in North Africa, where you're entering into these megalithic monuments, and they're basically like the body of the deity.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in Malta, you see this.
Mm-hmm. I was just about to go there. Okay.
So that in itself, I mean, that when I went to Malta, I really. I had found my place, in a sense, especially when I went to Menidra, which is a little temple. I got to Malta, let's see, this was in 1979, and this is before Malta had really been discovered, in a sense. And I arrived there after a very long trip. I hadn't been abroad for a long time. And I arrived there at sunset, and I went immediately to Menidra, which is right on the sea. And I was the only one there. There was nobody around. And I walked down to the temple, and it suddenly became dark. And I entered the temple with those huge stones. And I really felt that the stones were vibrating. I felt something in there.
Hmm.
And I suddenly realized that also my heart was beating very fast. And I could hear the sea underneath, the rocks and the sea and so on. It was quite remarkable.
I don't know, the sense I'm getting hearing you describing is this, Goddess was alive, as nature.
Well, yes.
Right there.
Yes. Yes. And I think that in Malta you really have that feeling, but you also have it in other places, in New Grange in Ireland, and in Maes Howe in the Orkney Islands, and looking at Silbury Hill in southern England. Places like that, places that inspired me in my quest for that later on became the Goddess Mound.
Well, that's where I was going to go next, because we're talking about this idea of temples as the body of the goddess. And we know from Malta, I mean, a lot of us who go there and study this stuff, when you walk inside these temples, especially like the mother-daughter temples, You know, we believe, we're taught that we are walking within the body of the goddess. You know, so we're literally, if we're going to do ritual there or pray there or meditate there, whatever we're doing, you know, we're doing it within her body, the hypogeum also. So did that in some way inspire the goddess mound? Can you tell us about the mound?
There's no question about it. Well, you said yourself, you described the mound very well. It's a sculpture of the great goddess as a temple that can be entered. And the outside looks like a large earth mound, and the inside consists of the negative shape of a female form giving birth. This is the goddess mound. And the exterior mound would be approximately something like 25 feet high and 75 feet in diameter and covered with wild grass. And the inside, which would be made out of concrete or something like that, you know, some new material, would be approximately 22 feet in height and 14 feet wide. And you'd be entering through a long passageway, very much the way you do in Newgrange in Ireland. And you'd be entering the negative shape of a female figure in a squatting position, in a birth-giving position. So you'd be going right through her vagina into her body. And the inside of her body, which you were intuit, because, I mean, it's a very large sculpture. It's 22 feet inside.
So where does the sculpture live right now? I mean,
in my imagination, and also in a pamphlet.
Okay.
Okay, it's not.
You have a rendering of it at this point.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
And is it possible to see this, your vision, at, I think, thegoddessmound.com?
Yes, goddessmound.com or www.christinabiaggi.com. You can see the goddess mound. But I had built one, a sculpture with a similar idea in my backyard. It's no longer in existence because I built it out of papier-mâché. And the sculpture that I created, which was called the Goddess Mound, was a double shell paper mache construction made of wood and paper mache and wire.
Mm-hmm.
And on the outside, it measured 24 feet by 14 feet and was about 8 feet tall. And the inside, it was about 18 feet by 8 feet and about 6 feet tall. And it represented the negative shape of a reclining female figure, six times life size, lying on her side, one arm draped along her hips, and her legs disappearing into the earth below her knees. And you would enter the figure through the navel.
Mm.
And again, because of its size, you didn't, you know, you intuited that it was the negative form of a female figure, but you didn't know it, you know, right away. You know, it looked like a cave.
Right. Well, and would I be wrong to assume that the inside would maybe be like a red ochre color or something
red
like
ochre
that?
Color, yes, red ochre color.
Okay. Well, Christina, I think we have a caller. Let me check and see if this caller here would like to ask you a question or if they're just listening. Let's hang on for a second.
Okay.
Hi, this is Karen. Did you have a question for Christina?
Yes. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thanks for calling. Go right ahead. Ask your question.
Thank you. First, I just want to thank you and Christina both for your work. I'm new on this path. I have been very interested, and I've been studying a lot about art. I'm an artist myself, and I've been studying about the effect of art in the psyche, in the soul. And I've developed a theory, and I'm just a student. I don't know anything concretely or anything, and I would like your input, your opinion about this. I feel that art and symbology, it's very valuable to humanity because it's an expression of the divine within. It's my own theory. It's just what I've, you know, I personally have experienced spiritual growth through art. I see your art, and I hear you speak, and I read your work, and I have the same sense. Do you share that viewpoint? Could you give me a little bit more, expand a little bit more on that at all? And my name is Lady Raina, and I really thank you both, Karen. You're amazing for your work.
Well, thank you for calling, Lydia. I'm glad you found the show.
Okay.
Well, I absolutely believe that, you know, the spiritual component of art, I mean, there's no question about it, you know. And when I think of sculpture, you know, I want sculpture to renew our thinking about architecture as a habitable sculpture in harmony with the environment, and sculpture as a symbolic embodiment of the goddess's presence and character, which forms an architectural whole with the landscape and is related to human need. I think that we need to go back to the sacredness of art. You know,
right.
And absolutely, it resonates within our body.
It does, doesn't it? It creates this energy, this effect, this spiritual growth.
It inspires mystery. Yes.
Yeah. And greatness and awe and everything that's spiritual,
exactly.
And that's divine, I think.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for calling, Lydia.
Okay. Lady Rana.
Lady, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Stay tuned.
Sure.
So, Christina, you were talking about the Goddess Mound, and you were hoping to create this Goddess Mound at a museum installation or an academic institution, or tell us your vision for this project.
Well, I was thinking of an academic institution because then all kinds of courses and seminars and things of that nature could take place in connection with the Goddess Mound.
Well, you know, I'm thinking even your first papier-mâché, stab at it. You know, you must have got some good rituals out of that before that papier-mâché disintegrated.
Well, I did, yeah.
That's wonderful. I'm sure you'll inspire other people to think about doing this as well.
I did it in a fever of creativity. It took me 2 months to do, and I had the help of a lot of people, especially women. And I did nothing else. I didn't go out. I didn't, you know, I just worked feverishly for 2 months to get it done, and I got it done in 2 months.
So, all right, so I'm trying to picture it. So you have a mound, which would I assume sort
from
of like...
From the outside, it looks like a large, large rock.
Oh, okay, so it's not grass, it's a rock.
No, it's a rock. It looks like a rock. In fact, people would pass by my house and think, what is that, a very large dog house? Because I have dogs. I've always had dogs. And I'd say, no, it's a structure. And you know, if I sensed that they were perceptive or something like that, I would say it's a kind of a goddess mound. You know, if not, I would just say it's a structure that can be entered, and it's mysterious inside. It's like a cave.
It's beautiful. Well, I think that's an incredible idea, and I certainly wish you the best of luck finding a benefactor who could sponsor this wonderful inspiration you have.
Yes, well, I would like to find somebody who would like this, and then we could find the funding for it.
A woman's university or something. You know, do you hear us out there? We're putting it out into the ethers. Well,
yeah.
Now besides the U Medusa, you also have a Raging Medusa piece that you made.
Oh yes, I have a series of Medusas. I have done about 8 Medusas. And the raging Medusa is basically, I did this when my partner, who is now, you know, passed, was very sick with cancer. And I think I was partly inspired by that for the Raging Medusa. And it's basically, it's a large piece. It's five feet in diameter, and it depicts Medusa in her rage, screaming basically, and she's the inspiration for that was Maria Callas singing at the Met. I had a picture of Maria Callas singing at the Met, and hitting a high C while she was doing Norma. And so you see this Medusa, doing that. And I think there's an image of her also on my website.
So was the raging Medusa, was that inspired by your rage because of your partner's illness? Or?
My partner's illness, but it also represents to me afterwards, because you don't think of these things before. You have an inspiration, and then you do it, and then suddenly you realize what you've done,
mm-hmm.
as an artist. To me, later on, I saw that it represents the rage of women duped and enslaved by patriarchy and the deepest anger of the earth herself at being so constantly cataclysmically devastated, because I, not only do I create art all the time, but I also write about it, and I also write about the goddess. I've written 3 books, and so my writing feeds my art feeds my writing. It's a two-way street.
Right, absolutely. They all overlap. Well, as you're talking, I'm getting these visual images, and really Medusa is a wonderful symbol for women's rage and the rage at their oppression. I'm just seeing this, this Medusa with the snakes in her hair, with her open mouth, and she's just, letting out this shrill yell because she is mad as hell, and she just, she just doesn't want to take it anymore. And
exactly.
It's
a good metaphor for the earth, who doesn't want to take it anymore. And exactly what's happening? We're expecting 2 major storms here in New York, with about 2 feet of snow. One storm with 1 foot, and another storm with another foot. I mean, then look at what's happening. The weather is all cockeyed.
Well, so would you say that Goddess sort of plays the central role in your work as an artist and writer?
I think so, absolutely. There's no question about it.
So she's sort of the primary inspiration.
Yes, she is.
I can understand that. I mean, she's sort of been at the core of everything I've done for about the last 20 years, too. It just feels like there's nothing more important than that.
Yeah. In her many manifestations.
Yeah, absolutely. And she feeds us on so many different levels.
Yeah.
Well, and now you also do nests and webs, I think, right?
I do nests. I've done a series of webs, and webs are also an ancient archetypal symbol derived, obviously, from animal art, the spider being. And its latest manifestation, or the manifestation of the 70s and 80s, it came to symbolize the wave of the feminist movement of the 70s and 80s. And my webs, and I've created about 8 of them. The first one was a double-sided collage that depicted women's movements way from the slavery movements, anti-slavery movements, the abolitionist movements, all the way to the 80s and to Greenham Common and Seneca Falls and places like that, where women were protesting against the nuclear establishment. So that was my first web. And then the other webs symbolized for me interconnection. And they were made of ropes of different hues, basically, reddish hues, and different lengths and widths. And I created these webs in various parts of, the United States, and also in Europe, in Switzerland and Italy. And it, to me, it became a symbol of interconnection with all living things and the need for peace, basically.
Yeah, and that idea that our patriarchal culture has tried to kill in us, the idea that we are interconnected and really should be caring about one another. Christina, you have researched a number of books. You've written Habitations of the Goddess and the Footsteps of the Goddess, A Rule of Mars. That must have been an incredible journey. A birth as well. I mean, I know whenever you write a book, it's for somebody who's not an author, they need to know that's like giving birth.
Have you written any books?
yeah, I've actually written 2. So,
you know.
Yes, yes, yes. And they're your child, and you know, and it's hard when you know, someone finds fault with your child too. It's very much like a mother and their offspring. It is a mother and their offspring. But your three books, was it just as you were finding this information out about Goddess, did you feel like, well, the world has to know about this? I mean, was that sort of the impetus behind these books? Or what can you tell us about the journey of those three books?
Okay, well, the first book basically was based on part of my dissertation, which was about the megalithic monument that symbolized the great goddess. That was my PhD dissertation. And it was about almost 700 pages long, which is infinitely too long for, you know, a book. So I just took, I asked Maria Gimbutas what she thought. I sent her the dissertation, and she invited me to Topanga Canyon, and I went there, and she gave me some very good advice. She said, Christina, take the dissertation and cut it in half. Just use the second half. You know, this is the way she talked. Just use the second half, the one about the Malta in Scotland, and publish that. And then you publish the other after that. So that's what I did. I just took the second part of the dissertation, which was the more original, you know, my remarks about Malta in Scotland, and the connection that I found between the structures in Malta and the ones in Scotland. And so I published it, and that was my first book.
So Habitations of the Goddess literally refers to her temples or any place that was a structure where she was venerated?
Exactly. Tombs, temples, and houses, and, you know, and it talked about that, and the artifacts connected with those places.
Okay. And then in the Footsteps of the Goddess, how is that one different?
That one is totally different. It's a much more, you know, Habitations was much more of a scholarly book because it was based on my dissertation. And in the Footsteps is basically a compilation of goddess stories provided by people, mostly women, but some men, from many walks of life, as well as the story of my own coming to the goddess, and this how this has transformed my life and work. But this is, you know, it was a small volume, about 100 and something pages, and I edited it, basically. I went around asking people how the female divine had influenced them, how they had found her, and how it had influenced or changed their life.
Well, I bet these two make wonderful bookends, because here you have the, you know, the linear, more, you know, academic, encyclopedic account of her history, and then you have the more right brain experiential in the second book.
Exactly, yes.
Well, you know, that's so funny, because it wasn't planned, but that's what happened with me as well. I mean, my first book was Sacred Places of Goddess Around the World, so it was that intense encyclopedia. And then the second one was much more experiential about, well, you know, how she manifested in the community that I worked in Los Angeles, and the sacred trips we went on and the tours I led. And it's just so interesting, that parallel there. I didn't realize that, but it's like how, you know, she affects us in such an important way on both the right brain and left brain level.
Yes. Are you an artist too?
No, I'm not I don't call myself an artist, but, you know, my husband and I have actually, in our home, we have the Isis Temple of Thanksgiving, and we have these murals of ancient Egypt and temples and things like that. And, you know, it doesn't feel like art to me, you know, like you do art, like you're a sculptor, and, but other people say, Karen, why don't you consider yourself an artist? But I don't know, I just don't. You know, it doesn't rise to the level of art, I guess, is in my mind anyway. But so then you had the third one, The Rule of Mars.
The Rule of Mars is totally different. It's about patriarchy. It's a compilation of articles from archaeologists, anthropologists, artists, poets, academics, representing, you know, various countries in the world and belonging basically to the major races of humankind. And the question I wanted to answer in this book, And again, I sent out questionnaires to various people from my various lists, you know, because I go to a lot of goddess conferences. Some of the questions were, how did patriarchy originate? When and where did it occur? And what events precipitated it and how it expanded? And what was the role of patriarchy? What is the role of patriarchy in our contemporary world situation? And why did patriarchy emerge as a cultural paradigm? You know, that kind of thing is, and it's divided into five sections, which attempt to deal with those. Not answer. You can't answer these things, but deal with these questions.
Okay. And now, are all three books still in print? Is it possible to get all three?
Well, let's see. The goddess, the Habitation of the Great Goddess has to be reprinted. But the Rule of Mars and the Footsteps are definitely in print.
Well, Christina, tell me. I mean, you know, you have been around a long time. You have seen a lot of things come, go. In your opinion, what's the state of goddess spirituality today? I mean, do you have hope that we are really shifting into a better time? Or what is the state of feminism today? Whatever you feel more comfortable answering. You know, I guess are we making progress? It just seems so slow.
I think we are. I'm very optimistic. I think we are. And even the thought, and I'm sure you were part of that whole discussion on the internet about Avatar. Okay. And I think, you know, in some ways, okay, that movie is a, you know, it's made by James Cameron, who made Titanic and all that, but I think it had some wonderful things in it.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, the goddess tree and the very fact that they worshipped a female divine, I mean, that was extremely positive. That's kind of like the goddess goes mainstream.
Well, you know, that's what I saw too, you know, and I thought to myself, well, if this incredible movie that, you know, this guy spent all of this money on, that's winning all these awards, and oh, if it could only, the Academy Awards hasn't happened yet, has it?
March 7th or 8th or something like that.
Well, imagine if it wins the Academy Award. I mean,
it probably will.
Oh, I hope so. You know, I mean, I'm getting goosebumps, you know, sitting here. but imagine it feeding so many minds.
You know, it's about the female divine, you know. I mean, these people worship her. And that scene where Sigourney Weaver dies underneath the sacred tree, my God, this is how I want to die. Surrounded by light underneath a tree that emits light with all these people chanting. Ah, that's just incredible.
Well, I thought so too, and actually, you know, I went and saw it twice, and I know I'm going to go see it
too.
And I'm going to go a third time in IMAX so that I'm totally surrounded in it. You know,
that's exactly what I'm going to do too.
But you know, it just made me feel so incredibly hopeful, and especially that so many people. I felt like it sort of inspired so much talk, and so many people just felt so connected to the message.
They did. Yes. Absolutely.
Well, and I guess I keep thinking too. You know, remember when I forget their names now, but Jack's girlfriend said, you know, the mother keeps things in balance, and
yes.
Then so here she sends her animals to balance things out. You know.
I know. Yes, and the mother doesn't take sides, but then she, you know, somebody came to the rescue.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm waiting to see what's going to happen on Earth, you know, how is the mother going to balance out what's happening on Earth unless it's these snowstorms and these earthquakes and I certainly don't have a crystal ball. I wish I did about this. I mean, do you think anything about the, you know, the 2012 prophecies or any of that? Can you tie that into any of this, or do you think they're?
I don't know about that. You know, I think we're beginning to see this, you know, with the storms and things like that. I don't know about this 2012. Did you see that movie 2012?
Yeah, I did. I couldn't resist. My husband and I like to go see those sorts of things.
I do too. But I thought it was, you know, it was nothing.
Well, you know what I took away from it? And I don't know that I didn't read anything about like this on any blog, because I started looking. I actually came away with the thought, okay, the message at the end was, on 2012, that the Chinese exploited their laborers so that the rich could inhabit these arcs, and it was the rich that lived. You know, I came away with, you know, not a very pleasant taste in my mouth, quite frankly.
You were right. I think, you know, I think you've got the nail, you've hit the nail on the head. I really do. I mean, in some ways, that's right. Yes, that's what.
Yeah, and I, you know, and if something like that happened, I can see that, you know, that very thing happening. You know, I'm still seeing the queen walking across to her ark, you know, with her little dogs, and you know, while the Chinese workers are beaten on the door so that they don't drown. You know, and they're the ones who built the ark.
Yeah.
Oh, life, patriarchy, right?
Yeah, patriarchy. Yes. Yeah.
There we go. Well, Christina, we've almost come to the end of our hour, and it's been so interesting. Can you believe it's already been almost an hour already?
No, I can't.
Well, time flies so quickly on the show. What you know, what ideas or thoughts would you maybe like to leave listeners with that I haven't thought to ask you? Is there anything we haven't covered that you feel is important?
Well, let's see. What am I working on now? I keep on working on, you know, various things connected with the goddess. I'm working on a series of Nike figures, which are, you know, what the Nike is. She's
Winged Victory?
What?
The Winged Victory. Are you talking about the Winged Victory?
Yes. I mean, she's based on the Paleolithic bird goddess. So that's what I'm working on right now, you know. And what I'd like to leave thoughts with the listeners is, you know, don't despair. Things are changing. I really believe that. And it's a matter of keeping your artistic vision, you know, intact and believing in it. And believing that art will transform, because it does.
Well, and I mean, we sort of digressed with the movie, but do you have any comments about you know, the state of feminism, or the fact that a lot of the younger women don't even think we need it anymore, or
there'll be a resurgence of that. I know. So, there's that, but there's also, you know, there are also other things that are going on, and I think, you know, there are little resurgences of goddess interest and feminist interest and so on. I can see it, as well as the negative. I mean, but there's also the positive.
Well, I certainly know from the people I talk to on the show that, and I say this so that listeners will have hope. I mean, I can see where, you know, the idea and the ideals of goddess or the sacred feminine is just springing up all over. It's not just Wiccans and pagans and feminists anymore.
You're right.
You know, it's really everywhere, and, you know, men and women of all different faiths, and, you know, maybe we call it different things, you know, but I mean, I even saw, you know, in the message of Barack Obama, I saw the sacred feminine, you know.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, and how people responded, you know, and you know, even now, as angry as I am with him, because I wish he would be more assertive, I wish he would be a little bit more, you know, the fighter, you know,
yes.
I kind of see that, you know, he is trying to still work in partnership, you know, instead of steamrolling over the other side, you know.
Yes, he's not ramming it down our throat the way his predecessor did.
And the world doesn't know what to do with that, you know.
They don't know what to do with it. You're right.
And especially the other side, you know. I mean, they just know power over and domination. And,
right.
You know, they take, you know, this idea of partnership as a weakness. It's really unfortunate. But
it's unfortunate, but it'll prevail at one point. It will, I think.
Well, Christina, thank you so very much. I want to mention your websites again. It's thegoddessmound.com. And,
or www.christinabiaggi.com. And you can go on my website that way. It's easier.
And I wish you the best of luck, finding a home for the Goddess Mound Project. And I can't wait to be one of the first ones to walk through her yoni into her womb.
Well, thank you so much, Karen. That's wonderful.
Well, thank you, Christina, and you've been a wonderful guest. I appreciate your time, and thank you for being willing to be on the show and talk to listeners.
It was a pleasure. It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Well, good night. I know it's late where you are, so thank you for staying up.
Oh, you're welcome. Good night.
Good night. Karen. Good night. So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just will save the world. I caught myself too many times saying might save the world, and I'm going to change that to will save the world. And our guest tonight was the delightful foremother, Christina Biaggi. Well, I am going to take a very brief 1 minute music break, and I mean that literally, 1 minute, and I'm going to return with the What's the Buzz segment. So for that minute, I'm going to let you listen to Breath of Passion by the group Zingaya. So please enjoy this for 1 minute, and I'll be right back talking about the topics that I mentioned to you at the top of the hour. Jump into our What's the Buzz segment that for the last 2 weeks we have not had on the show, so I have a lot to catch up on. So I'd like to start with asking ourselves, are we walking our talk when it comes to spirituality and politics, or are we supporting those who would throw our ideals under the bus, and do we even know the difference? Or are Americans becoming so easily duped? Are we becoming such sheeple that we can't tell who will support policies that uplift us and will improve our lives versus groups whose policies exploit us and make us less prosperous, less free, and less equal? I think this became an important issue for me when I hear women say, they supported institutions or groups that didn't really support them or have their best interests in mind, whether it was the church or the Republican Party, neither of which generally see women as equal to men or support policies that uplift women and give them equal rights. You know, when it comes to the Republican Party, unless you're pretty rich, making probably $250,000 a year, $250,000 a year, then the GOP has nothing for you. Yet they dupe people every day into voting against their economic interests and voting for the party of the corporation. You know, even our foremother, Rianne Eisler, author of The Chalice and the Blade, in such an important book to help us understand what came before and, how our culture has changed under patriarchy. Well, she's come out saying that if Goddess were to choose a political party, given the two we have now, it would be the Democratic Party. So if you're a goddess advocate, if you value diversity, tolerance, balance, harmony, justice, equality, partnership over patriarchy, are you aware if you're supporting people and platforms that work against those ideas? And, you know, and some of the other inspiration to get me talking about this was, you know, there are pagans who want to bury their head in the sand. And instead of talking about the stuff that's happening in the world that affect our everyday life, they want to sort of just talk about, well, what's the best oil or the color candle to use at their altar? And, you know, they don't want to open their minds to the inequities going on out in the world regarding freedom of religion or freedom of women. You know, if you're not a member of one of the three major religions, do you know your religion is considered a second-tier religion, and it might not be afforded all the rights of the first-tier religion? Well, in the Bush administration, second-tier religions were overlooked when it came to getting other rights afforded the first-tier religions. I actually have an article I just put on my Examiner column today about first and second tier religions. If you don't know about that, you really should go and take a look. See if what you believe is a first tier religion that's really protected by our freedom of religion laws, or if you're a second tier religion and your rights aren't quite so protected. Then there was this other instance. Take this pagan fella who thought I was too tough on Fox News because I was talking about them distorting facts and pretending to be fair and balanced when they're just a propaganda arm of the Republican Party. I asked him, pagan fella, do you think Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck, or Bill O'Reilly are going to give your pagan back, or going to have your pagan back, or going to worry about your pagan rights? I mean, Bill O'Reilly has already publicly disparaged Wiccans. I can just imagine Glenn Beck going psycho about goddess people being the devil. I mean, after all, Sarah Palin's church, if you want to remember all those YouTube clips from last year during the McCain-Obama run for the presidency, showed her church against the Queen of Heaven. Well, you know, the Queen of Heaven that they were calling a demon, that's the goddess. You know, are these people going to worry about your freedom of religion or, given the chance, be the first to burn and ban your books? Or are they going to be open to the idea of goddess and the sacred feminine? Or do they want to keep it swept under the rug, denying the value it offers for a balanced and harmonious world? Remember, they want to teach Genesis in schools. The Tea Party folks are already race-baiting and being vocal about their disgust of immigrants and minorities. You know, I had a transgender friend who defended Republicans with every ounce of passion in her body. And I finally asked her, I said, do you think they would approve of your sexual preferences, of your transgender identity? Would they embrace you? Would they welcome you with open arms? Or at best, would they try to cure you? Or at worst, reject you because they would think you were an abomination of nature, like, you know, so many talk about gays today? Well, you know, I had another pagan fellow on a Yahoo list I was on say to me, why should he worry that the Bible denigrates women and gives men license to oppress women? He actually said that. I mean, I would be embarrassed to say that, but he had no shame. And, you know, I have family who live in the South who think it's perfectly fine for women to have their reproductive rights controlled by the government or have women as second-class citizens. That thinking is out there. You know, it's programmed into so many people, and we really have to work against that ignorance and oppression, those isms. So I guess I'm asking you to ask yourself, what kind of a world do you want to live in? One where we try to see to it as best we can that all our boats float, that there's justice, equality, tolerance, diversity, peace, harmony on the planet? Or are you going to support people who are fear-mongers, racist, sexist, misogynists, who are perfectly content and see nothing wrong with putting greed and profits before people? Because those aren't goddess ideals. And if you're a goddess advocate, how do you reconcile your spiritual beliefs and your cultural and political beliefs? Some of these people see nothing wrong with there be no level playing field, as long as they're on top, you see. Who can spend unlimited money on war but don't give a darn about if people have health care or education? So let me just close with some statistics from a poll that really disturbed me that came out recently. And I have this on my Examiner column, too. It's one of the entries I made. I talked about how, you know, God has disappeared from the center of cultures, spiritualities, and our psyches because of a concerted effort on the part of some who wanted to wrestle power away, to rewrite history. And humanity, particularly women, are suffering clearly for that patriarchal political strategy. And today, the selective memory or distortion of history and circumstances continues, thanks to media outlets like Fox News and other pundits who care more about profits and regaining power and control than disseminating truth or encouraging discussions of ideas or policies that might actually help uplift and educate average Americans. So, you know, this sort of ties into what I was talking about, the dumbing down of America and the movement against against intellectualism. On Voices of the Sacred Feminine, that's really one of my concerns. So when I saw this poll on the Daily Kos, it really sort of stuck out for me as proof that, you know, this programming that I've been worried about that has been happening because of the hour after hour, day to day, year to year programming of, you know, of lies and spin that, you know, some vulnerable Americans are being spoon-fed by commentators. It's playing itself out in polls. You can see it's having an effect. For instance, the Daily Kos Research 2000 poll of self-identified Republicans, only 42% of self-identified Republicans believe President Obama was born in the United States. That means 60%, just about almost 60%, don't believe he was born in the United States. 53% say Sarah Palin is more qualified to be president than Obama. This is the woman who writes on her hand, okay? 31% say President Obama is a racist who hates white people. Well, that's Glenn Beck stuff. That's Rush Limbaugh stuff. That's crazy. 63% say Obama is a socialist. You know, most of them don't even know what socialism really is. Tonight, Newt Gingrich was talking about what he said says socialism was. And, you know, he just really described the Bush administration. You know, it's insane, the beliefs that are out there. 40% believe President Obama should be impeached, even though he's committed no crime, okay? But, of course, they don't want Bush or Cheney investigated for war crimes. And further, you know, just a glimpse into the minds of those polled, 31% believe contraceptives should be outlawed. 26% say openly gay men and women should be allowed to serve in the military. Only 26%. So that's more than, you know, 70% say they shouldn't. Only 8% believe, you know, gay people should be allowed to teach in public schools. Only 8%. So that's, you know, 92% believe gays shouldn't be able to be educators. 7% say same-sex couples should be allowed to marry. So do the math. 93% want to take, you know, the civil rights, you know, to marry the one you love away from gays. 34% say birth control is abortion. 91% will support the death penalty, however. And 76% say abortion is murder. So abortion is murder, but they support the death penalty. Kind of a discrepancy there. And 67% believe the only path to heaven is through Jesus Christ. Well, tell me, please, why are these people who believe in Jesus Christ not acting more like the teachings of Jesus Christ? That's the hypocrisy that just gets under my skin. 77% said public schools should teach the book of Genesis as an explanation of how the world was created. 77%. I mean, Walter Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow, we hope you aren't watching what passes for journalism today. Well, Patrick McCullum, who's been a guest on Voices of the Feminine, says, when pagans get their rights everyone benefits. I might add, when women get their equal rights, when gays get their equal rights, when there is no longer exploitation and oppression, then everyone will benefit. Let's see. The next topic, and I guess the next point in What's the Buzz kind of parallels the last. I'm talking about the unfortunate ugliness in the Christian culture these days. Do you know United States Christians, like the politically motivated group called The Family, are behind a law in Uganda that will jail or kill gays and require family and friends of gays to turn them into authorities? You know, people stood by and did little when Hitler went after Jews, too. Remember how that ended? I mean, does this not smack of that or the Inquisition to you? And since prominent leaders in the military, government, and society are coming out trying to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the practice in the military that discriminates against gays, you know, the homophobia has just been, you know, in overdrive. And if you think that's just in faraway places, recently MSNBC's host Chris Matthews interviewed Peter Sprigg of the Family Research Council, saying U.S. Christians believe we should jail gays. I have a transcript of their interview right here, and Matthews says, "I'm just asking you, should we outlaw gay behavior?" And Sprigg says, "I think there should be a place for criminal sanctions against homosexual behavior." Matthews asks, "So we should outlaw gay behavior, right?" Sprigg says, "Yes." The American Family Association sent out an email action alert with the subject being Obama's New Military, Gays Showering with Straights was the headline. As one might expect, the email is filled with an ugly homophobia and encourages the faithful to flood their representatives in Congress with demands not to repeal the military's anti-gay policy. Here's an excerpt from that action alert. "Gays showering with straights. Absolutely. If President Obama, congressional Democrats, and homosexual activists get their wish, your son or daughter may be forced to share military showers and barracks with active and open homosexuals who may very well view them with sexual interest. Talk about creating a hostile work environment for people who practice normal sexuality. The alarmist paranoia is actually quite silly. The fact is gays have always showered with straights, be it in prison, the military, or the high school gym class. Wherever there were communal showers, there will be gay people. Gays have always been in the military. Gays have always been with us. They always will be." And I want to thank Micah Stone. He is the Portland Humanist Examiner. He always has interesting articles. And it was thanks to him that I actually ran across this interview that Chris Matthews did with this fellow, Peter Sprigg, of the Family Research Council. But, you know, the reality is there should be there shouldn't be discrimination no matter who you are. This shouldn't just be trying to get rid of discrimination in the workplace for gays. There shouldn't be discrimination at all. And what about recently, this went around. Now, whether this was a real letter to Dr. Laura Schlesinger or just a literary device to make a point, I think the point is obvious. This email went around saying that someone was responding to her radio show, and this is what it says. On her radio show, Dr. Laura Schlesinger said, "As an observant Orthodox Jew, homosexuality is an abomination according to Leviticus 18:22 and cannot be condoned under any circumstance." Well, the following response is an open letter to Dr. Laura penned by a U.S. resident, which was posted on the Internet. It's funny as well as informative. I want to share this with you because lots of my friends just love this. "Dear Dr. Laura, thank you for doing so much to educate people regarding God's law. I have learned a great deal from your show and try to share that knowledge with as many people as I can. When someone tries to defend the homosexual lifestyle, for example, I simply remind them that Leviticus 18:22 clearly states it to be an abomination. End of debate. I do need some advice from you, however, regarding some other elements of God's law and how to follow them. The first one is Leviticus 25:44 says that I may possess slaves, both male and female, provided they're purchased from neighboring nations. A friend of mine claims that this applies to Mexicans, but not Canadians. Can you clarify? Why can't I own Canadians? The second one, well, I'd like to sell my daughter into slavery as sanctioned in Exodus 21:7. In this day and age, what do you think would be a fair price for her? The third one, I know that I am allowed no contact with a woman while she's in her period of menstruation, that uncleanliness. It says so in Leviticus 15:19-24. The problem is, how do I tell? I've tried asking, but most women just take offense. The next one, when I burn a bull on the altar as a sacrifice, I know it creates a pleasing odor for the Lord, because it says so in Leviticus 1-9. The problem is, my neighbors, they claim the odor is not pleasing to them. Should I smite them? The next one, I have a neighbor who insists on working on the Sabbath. Exodus 35:2 clearly states he should be put to death. Am I morally obligated to kill him myself, or should I ask the police to do it? Number six, a friend of mine feels that even though eating shellfish is an abomination, Leviticus 11:10, it is a lesser abomination than homosexuality. I don't agree. So can you settle this? Are there degrees of abomination? Number seven, Leviticus 21:20 states that I may not approach the altar of God if I have a defect in my sight. I have to admit that I wear reading glasses. Does my vision have to be 20/20, or is there some wiggle room there? Number eight, most of my male friends get their hair trimmed, including the hair around their temples, even though this is expressly forbidden by Leviticus 19:27. How would they die? Number nine, I know from Leviticus 11:6-8 that touching the skin of a dead pig makes me unclean, but may I still play football if I wear gloves? Number 10, my uncle has a farm. He violates Leviticus 19:19 by planting two different crops in the same field, as does his wife by wearing garments made of two different kinds of thread, cotton and polyester. He also tends to curse and blaspheme a lot. Is it really necessary that we go to all the trouble of getting the whole town together to stone them, as it says to do in Leviticus 24:10-16? Couldn't we just burn them to death at a private family affair like we do with people who sleep with their in-laws, Leviticus 20:14? I know you've studied these things, Dr. Laura, extensively, and thus enjoy considerable expertise in such matters, so I am confident you can help. Thank you again for reminding us that God's Word is eternal and unchanging. Your adoring fan. And it's signed, James Kaufman. Well, all right, next. So what about, remember the Christian Coalition saying that New Orleans deserved Hurricane Katrina because of the sin of homosexuals, and Haiti deserved their recent catastrophe because they made a pact with the devil? I guess red states who suffer from tornadoes and fires and floods escape his purview. Or what about all the people suffering from the seeming unceasingly snow that's falling? What have they done? Or what about Dallas pastor Robert Jeffers? I want to tell you about him. In his recent guest column for On Faith, Dallas pastor Robert Jeffress stated that the decision by Air Force Academy officials in Colorado Springs to construct an outdoor space for the worship of pagan deities is, and I quote, an open invitation for God to send his harshest judgments against our nation. Okay? An open invitation for God to send his harshest judgment against our nation because the Air Force Academy officials in Colorado Springs constructed an outdoor space for the worship of pagan deities. You know, pagans are currently fighting for our rights on many fronts. We mentioned earlier Patrick McCollum. He's waging a legal battle with the state of California over the rights of pagan prisoners. The state is arguing that only five faiths, Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Muslims, and Native Americans, have a special standing that entitle their prisoners to a chaplain and religious services. McCollum and the pagan prisoners are arguing that all faiths are entitled to equal consideration. If they win, they'll secure rights not just for pagans, but for many other faiths and traditions. Well, when we honor and respect the great diversity of faiths, we assure that our own doorway, too, will remain open. This was an article, I believe, from Starhawk. When pagans get our rights, everyone benefits. And what about that new feminism touted by evangelicals that really dupes women, implying it's about honoring them, but then when you look more closely, it tells women they can get a divorce on grounds of adultery or abandonment, but not if their husband abuses them? And this ugliness goes beyond trying to oppress or suppress gays and women. It's frightening. On President's Day, a couple Mondays past, Christians were praying for Obama's death. And you see that hate and intolerance at the teabagger rallies, too. The Daily Beast reported that apparently many right-wing Christians were encouraging each other on President's Day through emails and tweets to offer a prayer against President Obama. This prayer asks God to kill, maim, curse, send into eternal damnation, or otherwise harm an enemy, in this case President Barack Obama. The prayer being pushed comes from Psalm 109:8, which says, "May his days be few, may another take his office." Even more disturbing, the next line reads, "May his children be orphans and his wife a widow." You know, the movement advocates include preachers across the country. Orange County's Wiley Drake and Arizona's Stephen Anderson are perhaps the most vocal in their support of the movement, both being obsessed with garnering media attention. Both are infamous and have been in the news for their very public sermons and diabolical prayers for the death of Obama. You know, there should be no place in American culture for this ignorance, hate, and bigotry that this type of Christianity spawns. And again, I want to thank Micah Stone, the Portland Humanist Examiner, for bringing this to my attention. He has a great column. You should check him out. You know, I asked some of you if you've been thinking about some of these issues I've been raising and what's the buzz. And I want to just thank those of you who sent in comments. You know, we've been talking about the ugliness of this loud Christian culture that, you know, I'm sure doesn't represent everyone. You know, we're speaking in generalities here. We're speaking about, the ones that are making all the noise that the media is covering. You know, of course, there are wonderful people of faith, of all different faiths, who are doing good things out in the world. I don't want to insinuate that I don't understand that or believe that. But I ask, you know, where are the moderate Republicans? Where are the moderate Christians? Where are the moderate Jews? Where are the moderate Muslims? That, you know, they should be speaking out against, you know, these people on the fringes, these fundamentalists that are giving, you know, their religion, giving their party a bad name. So anyway, let me get to some of the comments that you sent in to me. One of my listeners sent in a quote from Thomas Paine, one of the United States founding fathers. And Thomas Paine said, "Whenever we read the obscene stories, the voluptuous debaucheries, the cruel and torturous executions, the unrelenting vindictiveness with which more than half the Bible is filled, it would be more consistent that we call it the word of a demon than the word of God. It is a history of wickedness that has served to corrupt and brutalize mankind. Belief in a cruel God makes a cruel man." I thought that was very interesting. Then I have another comment. "I think it's a real sociological statement to bring out in a sci-fi show that monotheism leads to fanaticism and terrorism. That's certainly true in our world." Oh, this listener is talking about the new show Caprica, because the monotheists are the fanatics and the terrorists, and the polytheists are the live and let live sort of people. So the comment goes on to say, "But Goddess welcomes all in her loving embrace. There's room for everyone. She encourages diversity and uniqueness. There was never a pagan holy war because plurality is encouraged since it's the way of nature." Good point. Thank you for that comment. Let's see. "Don't you just love how the GOP tries to rewrite history? And it's history from last in its history from last year or last month or last week. This belief that if you repeat the lie over and over, the sheeple will believe it. Sadly, far too many do. While the Democrats take a more live and let live approach, what I find interesting is the constant cry from the left for us to be better at playing the Republican game. But perhaps we're really incapable of being so deceitful. Then there's another comment. And, you know, I see this steamroll, this total obliteration of truth happening every day. Dems versus GOP. GOP rewrite history to suit them. Dems aren't the rabid dog, gutter fighters in the street. They're more live and let live. I think this is playing out over and over, the different ways to be, to see, to treat, and to govern. The obvious racism is incredible. It's just so out there. The cries denying the racism are ridiculous. How can people not see it? I refer to this as willful ignorance. They know they've got it wrong, but prefer things the way they are because they still retain a measure of power, even if that power is an illusion. It's the old having a beer with Bush or Sarah Palin being one of us. Somehow I doubt her followers have received a dinner invitation. I tell myself if Hillary had ended up being president, we'd be trading in the racism and dealing with misogynist crap on top of everything else. Liberal, socialist, elitist, etc. The favorite dirty words of the right. The next. I console myself by remembering the metaphysical principle that like attracts like. The more we put out the words, thoughts, and energies of progressive, liberal, goddess ideals, the more people of like vibration and mind will be attracted. It will grow exponentially. Those of us who honor goddess are part of a living, growing energy field. Every time we share what we know, we light up other lives with awareness of her. Some do this in a whisper, others in a shout, but however we do it, we awaken others to the reality of her presence and her way of being in the world. You wake people up every time you do your show or write an article or publish a book, and those people go to share what they know with others, the living embodiment of goddess and interconnectedness. The next comment. As for the racism, I hear them using the N-word very loud and clear. No N is going to tell me what to do. I'm from the South. I know that sickening mentality, and they're so ignorant they can't even see past the racism to be smart enough to want someone brighter than them in charge. What is this country coming to? Another one. The ultimate recent irony was Sarah Palin taking pot shots at Obama about being professional and using a teleprompter. This from the mistress of flubs who uses teleprompters and endless notes, and now she writes on her hand. But it's what the dumbed-down teabagging masses want to hear and believe, and they just bore out the statistics you had in the article. Heavy sigh. And here's a comment about Avatar. We spoke about that tonight with Christina. I can't wait to see Avatar again. It's such an incredible film. I nearly lost it when Grace's voice whispered, "I'm with her. She's real. Yes, she is real, and we are her agents in the world." I felt the same heart-rending feelings that watching them destroying Pandora was like watching the centuries of attacks here on planet Earth against Goddess. I honestly believe if anyone spoke to James Cameron, it was her. My niece, who's studying to be a vet, shrieked out loud with joy when the creatures came to her defense. I think the more of us that are able to communicate with her, the more likely that becomes, which is why I think the ideas of Avatar and its huge reach is perfectly timed, guided by her hand. Well, you're hearing that beeping. That means my battery on my phone is getting low. So I'm going to switch phones here so I forgive the noise. And I'm going to finish some of these other comments before we move on, because I thank you for taking the time to send these in. Next comment. Oh, I thought the same thing about Cheney in the wheelchair. Oh, this was about some of my listeners were writing in saying they thought when Cheney was in the wheelchair at President Obama's inauguration that was one of the first signs that they were going to try to delegitimize his presidency, that, you know, he wasn't going to stand up while President Obama was being sworn in. So this writer says, oh, I thought the same thing about Cheney in the wheelchair. Everyone else thought I was nuts or reading something into things that wasn't there. It's also incredibly racist and transparent. So every last tea bagger is white. Not one person of color in that whole crowd of fools. I just wish sometimes they'd cop to it and pull out their KKK wardrobe and be honest about it. I told a friend recently I thought the emperor's new clothes metaphor would die once Bush left office, but it's still applicable to the right and their shenanigans. Can't people see the blatant racism? They have never criticized a white president the way they go after Obama. You can almost hear them saying, how dare a black man lecture me in that professional tone? Sarah Palin said essentially that in her recent address to her base of teabagging idiots. Let's see what else. I'm really concerned with the direction things are headed with the Sarah Palins and Glenn Becks and Rush Limbaughs of the world. For a while now, years actually, going back into the Bush debacle, I've noticed a rise in conservative right-wing pagans and Wiccans who seem to think that by aligning themselves with what they perceive as the dominant power, which is a typical patriarchal response, this somehow makes them safe. Well, it doesn't. As you say, the right would be the first ones to bring back burning at the stake or legislation against non-Christians or any host of other horrors. And the right-wing aligned pagans would not be in any way immune. If they don't seem to get that, what frustrates me is the head-in-the-sand mentality of many pagans. Do they think by ignoring it, it will go away? If only, have we learned nothing from the past? Okay, well, that's enough comments, and thank you, listeners, for writing in. I wanted to know what you thought out there, and I see that there's a lot of frustration out there and worry and concern about the distortion that's happening and the ugliness. Well, finishing up What's the Buzz, the week of Super Bowl Sunday, we're a little behind, but it's still relevant. You know, when my home team, the Saints, finally won after more than 40 years of never making it all the way to the Super Bowl, a study came out that finally supported what until now had only been anecdotal evidence. The article says, football upsets increase domestic violence. The study by the economist David Card at Berkeley and Gordon Dahl at the University of California in San Diego looked at police reports of family violence on Sundays during the professional football season. And you can actually go to this website and see all the statistics. They say they found that upset losses by the home team were associated with higher rates of domestic violence. In fact, an upset typically led to an 8% increase in police reports of at-home incidents where a man attacked a female partner. Upset losses in games involving a traditional rival had an even bigger effect on the rate of partner violence, as did unexpected losses after games involving an unusual number of sacks, turnovers, or penalties. Previous research documented a rise in domestic violence associated with other external factors, such as hot weather or holidays. This new paper also finds that major holidays are associated with spikes in reported domestic violence incidents, with the biggest increases being on New Year's Eve, Memorial Day, and the 4th of July, and even Thanksgiving, when the rate of partner violence typically increases 22%. Next topic is Costa Rica elects its first woman president. Laura Chinchilla, a social conservative who opposes both gay marriage and abortion, has won election as the first woman president of Costa Rica. Her election also brings the first Jewish vice president of that country. Chinchilla's running mate is Louis Lieberman. Well, is it reason to be happy? Some are reserving opinion because she's so conservative and Catholic, because as Sarah Palin taught us, any vagina just won't do. It's not in the genitals. It's more about, are you for the people? Are you for oppression? Or are you for civil rights? Let's see, I'd like to end on an up note, because there is a lot of ugliness out there, and I'd like to end on something positive. Here's what pagans can accomplish when they work together. And I want to thank Lady Arwen of Pagan Pride in Los Angeles for sending this around. These were some statistics that were compiled in 2009 for various Pagan Pride events that were held last year in the United States and overseas. I think it's a testament to what we can accomplish when we work together on a common goal. And just some of the statistics are, let's see, 24,000 pounds of food donations were turned in for the needy. Other donations reported over 900 pounds of animal food and animal care products, goods for pagan prisoners, maternity and baby care items, personal hygiene items, books, gently used clothing, and over 70 pints of blood donated. Some of these events were in places like not just the United States, but across the globe in Brazil, Mexico, Paraguay, Germany, Italy, and Canada. In the U.S., these pagan pride events were in a number of states: New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Missouri, New Mexico, Texas, Connecticut, Maine, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio, Tennessee, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Mississippi, Illinois, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Colorado, Montana, Utah, Arizona, California, Nevada, Washington. Altogether, 33 states out of 50 had pagan pride events that they were doing, you know, good things for the community. And in 2010, we have new events in the UK and the Philippines, plus new events in places in Canada and Uruguay. And as Lady Orwin and Gina Leslie says, thank you is never enough, but thank you to everyone who helped plan, work, promote pagan pride events, those who answered last-minute calls for help, no matter what we needed, loading and unloading vans, donations, whatever we needed, you were there. So thank you for giving us that positive feedback. Well, that concludes our What's the Buzz segment for tonight, and as long as you keep telling me you like this and as long as there are important things to talk about, I will be a voice for the ideals of the great she. We have to try our best to teach and share ideas that offset negative and toxic attitudes that breed intolerance, hate, war, exclusivity, disharmony, injustice, imbalance. You know, as I'm fond of saying, we have to keep working to reach that 100th monkey, to shift that paradigm, to put that morphic field in motion so change comes, and it will. And we're seeing it. I know it doesn't seem like it's happening fast enough, but we're seeing it happen every day. Look at the movie Avatar out there in the mainstream world. So let's use the steam of Bridget, the tenacity of Sekhmet, the social justice of Kali and Lady Libertas to set this in motion. So with that being said, the bees are released from my bonnet for yet another week. We'll get on to announcements now. Let's see what we have here. The queen of your realm. Let's go to February 28th. In Vista, California, Mary Magdalene, Goddess of the Western Traditions workshop is going to be happening at Elder Palm Sanctuary in Vista, California. If you want more information about this Mary Magdalene Sunday workshop given by Joan Norton, author with Margaret Starbird of 14 Steps to Awaken the Sacred Feminine, Women in the Circle of Mary Magdalene and the Mary Magdalene Within, you can contact MaryMagdaleneWithin.com. That is Sunday, February 28th. Don't miss it. I know Joan. She's a great teacher. I think you'll enjoy being in her presence. Also, Cakes for the Queen of Heaven is ongoing, and in fact, this Saturday, February 27th, is session 4 of 5 in Series 1, The Shift from Goddess to God. We're going to talk about the loss of female power and ways we lose and give away power personally. Then on March 13th, Reclaiming Women's Heritage of Power. Then we take a break in April, and we do the second part of the series, May 8th, 22nd, June 12th and 26th, July 10th and 24th. We'll be covering topics like the Hebrew goddess, Sarah the Priestess, Mary Magdalene, the Virgin Mary, witchcraft, and intentions, the new world view that has emerged in recent decades, and our hopes for ourselves and our institutions that share dreams of the future that are embedded with goddess ideals. That has already happened, and so has this. All right. In Northern California, in May 16th, her church, the Feminist Methodist a group up there has invited me to come discuss the art of sacred pilgrimage and the mysticism of sacred sites of Goddess. So if you're in the San Francisco area, let's connect. If you're up there, I'd love to have you attend and love to meet you if you're one of my listeners. Remember my motto, have Sistrum will travel. I'm available to talk to your group or church if you want to sponsor me to come teach in your city. Let's see. Also, for Goddess Advocates Everywhere, the Goddess Conference in Glastonbury is going to happen 2010. They have their information on their website if you want to go to goddessconference.com. And for those of you who keep asking me if I'm going to be doing another tour, I am going to be leading a goddess tour to Turkey in 2011. So please send me an email. Let me know you're interested. I'll put you on a list so that when we have the itinerary and the price and everything set, you'll be the first to know. Or just watch my website, because as soon as I have details, I will be posting it to the website as well. And for listeners who are getting to know me a bit better, do you know I have 2 years of archived radio shows on my website from when I was on Passionate Internet Voices Radio? Yep, they're right there and downloadable and free. I've had wonderful guests like Jean Houston, Margaret Starbird, Selena Fox, Rhianne Eisler, Matthew Fox, Patrick McCollum, so many wonderful leaders and movers and shakers, all working diligently for Goddess ideals and to make the world a better place. So go there when you can and listen. Remember, they're free. And I hope you'll check out my articles at examiner.com. It's kind of like my blog. I'm one of only a very few Goddess advocates in the United States writing for The Examiner. You can find me by going to examiner.com and putting my name in the search box. Articles by me or about me will pop up, or you can find a link on the homepage of my website, KarenTate.com. Right near the top middle of the homepage, there's a link, and it'll take you right to the Examiner column. I quite often talk about the politics of spirituality, whether it's healthcare or sexism or the inhumanity of political platforms that put profits before people. In my last article, I commented on, well, on one of my last articles, I commented on Obama's State of the Union message and the Republican reaction that once again proved what Foremother Rhianne Eisler said, and I mentioned earlier, if Goddess had a political affiliation, it would be Democrat. I invite you to visit the media page of my website and catch the radio interviews I'm invited to do, or you can go to my YouTube channel where I have some wonderful videos of the Isis Temple of Thanksgiving, Sekhmet's Mountain Sanctuary, and snippets of a lecture I gave on the Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future at a recent conference. And did you know there are also free downloadable meditations on my website at KarenTate.com. While you're there, check them out. Check out my books. Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destination. It's garnered some prestigious endorsements. It's a round-the-world look at Goddess across continents and cultures. Whether you actually travel to the places or you're just an armchair traveler, learn about Goddess all around the world on every continent. And then my second book, Walking an Ancient Path, won a place as a finalist in the USA National Best Books of 2008. It's more of an experiential book. It talks about incorporating Goddess spirituality into one's life. The Earth section, for instance, talks about some of the sacred journeys I've taken and, you know, the mystical and esoteric experience of being in these powerful places where Goddess was once revered. And, you know, there's a fire section that talks about tenacity and politics and transformation, and an air section that discusses how Goddess inspires us. Water section, it talks about doing ritual and our emotions. I think it's a pretty good book, if I don't say so myself. And the scholar David Hillman remarked about the book that Walking an Ancient Path is an immensely pleasurable and enlightening journey that stands boldly against the patriarchal denigration of the divine feminine. So I hope you don't mind the shameless plug for my two books. Go to my events page, see if I'll be appearing in a town near you, see what talks I have available to give your group. Check out my articles and links page, referring you to people around the world making a difference. And take advantage of the offer I have on my website in the Goddess Store. Both my books are $25 plus shipping and handling. That's actually cheaper than you can get them on Amazon. Now, remember, here on Blog Talk, we can take your caller questions. So if you like, you can always dial in and ask questions of my guest, or you can talk to me toward the end of the show, like right now, during or after my What's the Buzz segment. When I see your call on the switchboard, I'll identify you by your area code and welcome you to have a chance to be our guest. And if you can't listen live or don't want to be on the air, you can always email me some of your questions in advance. But most of all, keep tuning in each Wednesday night at 6 o'clock. Don't miss us. In fact, you can join Blog Talk as a listener and have reminders sent to your email box of our shows so you won't forget about our awesome guests each week. And please, if you're a fan of the show, please indicate that by selecting us as a favorite on Blog Talk Radio. So before I close, I want to just tell you about the coming guests for March. Can you believe we are already almost in March? Well, on March 3rd, my guest is going to be Heidi Gottner-Abendroth. She's actually calling in from Europe to discuss ancient matriarchies, the importance of ideals of matriarchies and our time, and her new book, Societies of Peace, Matriarchies, Past, Present, and Future. Then on March 10th, we have Michael York, goddess advocate Michael York. He'll discuss the paper he gave at the Parliament of World Religions called Men Who Love Goddess. Then March 17th, we have Leslie De La Madre. She's an author and a wonderful author, and she is going to discuss what it was like raising daughters in patriarchy and offer advice on how to keep the lineage from mother to daughter intact and raise bright new voices for goddess. And the final show of March is a twosome. Julie Raymond is going to be on the show, and scholar David Hillman returns. Julie is the author of We the Trees, a book of goddess fiction about ancient priestesses in Cappadocia, which is Turkey, is what we call the region today. We're going to discuss how our ancestral memory helps us in creative ways as we rethink, reclaim, and remember past lives, courageous women, and ancient times. Then at the bottom of the hour, scholar David Hillman will discuss the new movie, Clash of the Titans, that will have been out that weekend. And we're going to compare mythology we've learned about the Greeks through a Christian Western lens versus what the original texts actually say and what the Greeks actually meant. If you've been tuning into the shows, you know this is sort of an ongoing conversation, and the movie Clash of the Titans just sort of gives us a backdrop for continuing more aspects of what the Greeks really meant and what we have lost in our culture because we see everything through this Christian or Western lens. Well, listeners, I want to thank you for tuning in another week to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Thank you for your encouragement. Your feedback is gas in my tank, literally. You keep me going. I enjoy doing this, and I enjoy hearing that you are enjoying it. So as I close the show for tonight, I am going to leave you listening to, I think I'm in the mood for Sekhmet. By Caitlin Breen. That's what I'm going to let you listen to. So good night, and thanks for tuning in. I hope you'll be back with us next Wednesday night at 6 p.m. So good night, and may the great She embrace you for the coming week in her golden wings. Hail Sekhmet.
Desert, heart, fire.